We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. Vulnerability more powerful than strength.
And peace that passes all understanding.
It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Our reading this morning is from a sermon given by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. called Loving Your Enemies, November of 1957. How do you go about loving your enemies? I think the first thing is this. In order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing self. And I'm sure that seems strange to you that I start out telling you this morning that you love your enemies by beginning with a look at self. The second thing that an individual must do in seeking to love his enemy is to discover the element of good in his enemy. And every time you begin to hate that person, and even think of hating that person, realize that there is some good, and look at those good points, which will overbalance the bad points. So somehow the isness of our present nature is out of harmony with the eternal oughtness that forever confronts us. Within the best of us, there is some evil, and within the worst of us, there is some good. When we come to see this, we take a different attitude toward individuals. When the opportunity presents itself for you to defeat your enemy, that is the time you must not do it. It might be in terms of a recommendation for a job. It might be in terms of helping that person to make some move in life. That's the time you must not do it. That is the meaning of love. In the final analysis, love is not this sentimental something that we talk about. It's not merely an emotional something. Love is creative, understanding goodwill for all men. It is the refusal to defeat any individual. When you rise to the level of love, of its great beauty and power, you seek only to defeat evil systems. Individuals who happen to be caught up in that system you love, but you seek to defeat that system. I've said in so many instances that as the Negro in particular and colored peoples all over the world struggle for freedom, if they succumb to the temptation of using violence in their struggle, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness. And our chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos. Violence isn't the way. But there is another way, and that is to organize mass nonviolent resistance based on the principle of love. It seems to me that this is the only way as our eyes look to the future. As we look out across the years and across the generations, let us develop and move right here. We must discover the power of love. The power, the redemptive power of love. And when we discover that, we will be able to make of this old world a new world. O boundless spirit of compassion, grace, and mercy, hear now the cries of our heart, our tribulations, our trials, our sorrows, our celebrations, our triumphs, our joys. And may they open in us a love for all that is, a love for all souls and all beings on this blessed earth. And open our hearts with compassion to the expansive and evolving cosmos. Amen. A caged animal. We've all heard that phrase, haven't we? We've all probably used that phrase rhetorically. And most of us have probably seen caged animals, but usually they're at a circus or someplace like that. But have you ever seen a wild caged animal that did not want to be caged? Well, I had the opportunity to do that a few years ago. I live in the third floor of an apartment building in the Great Hills area that backs up to a protected park area. And so the raccoons would climb all the way up a brick wall, three stories, and get up into my cathedral ceiling, and had a nice family going there for quite some time. And so eventually, I called the apartment manager, and they sent out the pest control people who set out a cage to trap the raccoon, and of course, they did trap the raccoon. And I went out to check on the raccoon, and here's what I got. I mean, even though I knew that the raccoon was in a cage, it scared the hell out of me. And there was that raccoon with its mouth bleeding and its claws bleeding because it was trying to get out of that cage and regain its freedom. Now, to be honest with you, that's kind of the way I felt the past 8 years. I have witnessed the spiritual values, the American principles that I have been taught from the cradle up, being ignored, degraded, spat upon, torn asunder, lied about, and then bragged about in public. My morals, conscience, innate human decency clawed at me like that raccoon did to escape that cage. And after a time, I decided I had to speak up and act. As the constitutional and ethical crisis crescendoed the last 4 years, I spent trillions bailing out my psychic energy, trying to channel my outrage, trying to constructively express the deep anger that I felt. And rather than allowing that dam to bust and unleashing more destruction and misery, I continued to seek in an alchemical fashion to somehow get something positive out of the rage that I was feeling. And like that raccoon, my primal instinct was to lash out, to claw at the cage with my bleeding paws and regain my freedom and the freedom of our Constitution, our laws, and all that is good and decent. And then on Tuesday, January 20th, just before noon Eastern Standard Time, I stood on the mall with about 1.6 or 1.8 million people freezing my little tuchus off, but feeling my soul unclench, my body soften, my breath begin to ease and deepen. So now that the tide has turned and the values we honor are in power, the spiritual question shifts. How do we carry ourselves? I've noticed even now after 5 months, it's taking time to shift gears. I'm just now getting where, when I hear the word president, I don't clench my body up. So when I was on the plane to the inauguration, I was sitting by a young woman who was reading a book. I was reading an article, an editorial about Barack Obama, about his appreciation of complexity and nuance. And you know how you get that feeling someone's trying to hide something from you? The woman kind of had the book doubled up and she was, you know, like this. And I thought, you know, what does that do to you? I go, I want to find out what that woman's reading, you know. And I kept trying to, you know, somehow not be too conspicuous about it. And finally, she opened the book to turn the page, and I saw the title of the book by an author named Ann Coulter. If Democrats had any brains, they'd be Republicans. Now, let me hasten to say that I am a political independent, and I do not believe that Unitarian Universalism is parallel to being a Democrat. Okay, let me be clear about that right off the bat. But I will say that several reactions went through my brain. One was, why are you reading that stuff? The second one, more refined, was, I'm wondering what you get out of a book like that. But I held back the dam, remained silent, and went back to my op-ed. Now, this is the individual level. On the collective level, how do we carry ourselves? I was involved at Co-op Radio here in Austin, Texas. Anybody ever listen to Co-op Radio? Well, as you may know, Co-op considers itself a revolutionary experiment, a bunch of radicals trying to change society. Well, you know what happens in groups like that? It's a dangerous place to be. Because you have a lot of wounded people who feel they've been put down. And so what I noticed happening over my 12 years at Co-op Radio was basically a pendulum swing. This group oppresses this group, and then they get defeated, and the other ones get in power, and this group oppresses the other one. It was kind of the attitude of, you screwed me, now I'll screw you. And of course, we know that's an endless cycle. Now, at the heart of Jesus' teaching is a little ditty called the Sermon on the Mount. I was really proud of my congregation that they knew which testament of the Bible that was in. I won't ask you guys. But this series of teaching, there's a section of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus goes back and forth, where he is contrasting the old law with his new covenant. And he has this rhetorical line, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you. And so in the one I want to cite, he said, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And then he presents a Zen-like koan. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the left cheek also. If someone sues you for your shirt, let them have your coat as well. If a Roman soldier conscripts you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. And so the point of this rabbi using this koan-like strategy is that we do not resort to our lowest instincts as human beings. The point is that the spiritually grounded person moves beyond those reflexive instincts. We do not mete out evil for evil, or violence for violence, even though in our gut sometimes That's what we'd like to do, whether it be verbally or physically. And we've probably all been there. If you have brothers or sisters, you've been there. Now, interestingly, as Unitarians and Universalists, we can appreciate this, that it took a devout Hindu to take the teaching of Jesus seriously and show us what this means in the modern world. And his name was Mahatma Gandhi. And I'm sure you've all seen the bumper sticker, "An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind." So personally and collectively, liberals and progressives, our question is, now will we turn the tables on them, or will we turn the other cheek? And Gandhi assures us that the practice, that means doing, not just coming to church and hearing it sound good, but the practice of nonviolence calls forth the greatest courage. Now, along with you and the whole world, I have been watching, observing then-candidate Obama, and now President Obama, and his style of engagement and his early governing strategies. During a campaign that made eternity look like a 3-day weekend, and on the biggest stage on the planet, and in the most intense media scrutiny ever, what can we glean from now President Obama that will help us be better Unitarian Universalists, better citizens, better neighbors, and better human beings? I'd like to look at three things: his demeanor, his words, and his deeds. What of those are worthy of emulation? I've closely studied Obama's demeanor, the way he carries himself. And I am drawn to his non-defensive, centered way that he handles himself. Think about the crisis with Reverend Wright, how he handled that. He ends up delivering a speech which will go down as a classic in American political oratory, a more perfect union, a spiritual and cultural masterpiece. And in that speech, he honored the pain of, quote, both sides or every side as one. It was something to behold, the way he handled the frontal and backstabbing attacks from the Clinton political machine and the Republican political machines, and his calm balance from the onset of the financial crisis till now. There are two scenes that stand out to me by far. I was in San Francisco the night that he won the Democratic nomination. And I don't know if you noticed, but the way that he walked out on that gigantic stage in that Denver football stadium, it wasn't the usual rah, 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 yeah, we kicked their ass, we've got confetti, we've got pom-poms, and la, 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 look what we did. He walked out. He had a focused, clear eye of the tiger. Like my buddy says, when you win, act like you've been there before. And it was amazing. He acted like he'd been there before. And at the inauguration, I don't know, I was looking on the Jumbotron. I was fortunate enough to be about 1/4 mile, and I could see little ants up on the stage there. But on the Jumbotron, I don't know if they were showing this on TV, but they were showing people as they came into the tunnel. Were they showing that on TV? And when, of course, the crowd was just prime. They were just staring intently at that Jumbotron, waiting for the moment that they would see Obama's face. And when he appeared in the tunnel, what I saw, once again, was not a man like triumphant, look what I did, look at all the great things that I've done, look at all the wonderful things I brought for my race, etc., etc. That was not the demeanor that he had. He had a calm, sober, contemplative, dignified humility. Like he was embodying the best of the American spirit from Washington to Lincoln to Roosevelt to Kennedy to King. And now Barack's words. His signature mantra from his emergence at the 2004 Democratic Convention. There's not a liberal America and a conservative America. There's a United States of America. There's not a black America and a white America. There's not an Asian America and a Latino America. There is the United States of America. And that's really the mantra that he kept all the way through, and I think he even keeps now as our president. And these words from his inaugural speech. On this day, we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. We have come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances, false promises, the recriminations, and worn-out dogmas that for too long have strangled our politics. By the way, one of my members gleefully said to me, Chuck, when I was listening to that, it was like listening to a Unitarian Universalist sermon. I'm kind of proud of that because mine's about the only sermons he's heard. And President Obama went on, for we know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, non-believers. So my atheist members reminded me or told me that's the first time in an inaugural speech that non-believers were recognized. We are shaped by every language and culture, drawn from every end of the earth. Old hatred shall someday pass. The lines of the tribe shall soon dissolve. As the world grows smaller, our common humanity shall reveal itself. And now Obama's deeds. I was impressed by the meetings he had with the Clintons and the McCains after defeating them. Even though I wasn't a fan of this, but he carried over Mr. Gates as his Secretary of Defense. He appointed Democratic rivals to the highest posts, Biden as his Vice President, Clinton as his Secretary of State. I bet this was an interesting occasion. I would love to have been there. A dinner at George Will's house with other columnists like David Brooks and Bill Kristol. Once again, a decision I didn't agree with, but asking Reverend Rick Warren to deliver the invocation. And have you seen the photo of Cheney with Obama's family? Have anybody seen that? If you haven't seen it, go home and Google that this afternoon. Because there is Cheney looking just like Darth Vader. And little Sasha is in front of him doing a dance like this. It's so classic. And this was a picture they took when Obama had won his Senate seat at the swearing-in back when he was a senator in Illinois. I can tell you, I would not have let my kids within a country mile of that guy. And one of my members told me that this was the most touching part of the whole inauguration, that as Obama embraced George Bush, and how he and Michelle walked out hand in hand to the helicopter, escorting the Bushes away. I can tell you, I definitely would have given the old adios. And then look at, in the first 100 days, his other deeds. Tightening ethics rules for the White House officials. Declaring a renewed transparency. Can you believe a president who says we're going to operate with a spirit of cooperation and that we are servants of the public? He's actually admitted mistakes several times in public without being asked and chided by reporters. He repealed funding restrictions for international organizations that provide abortions, but he did not do it on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which all the presidents have been doing, to make a political statement because Obama says, I want to try to depoliticize this process. And he's committed to trying, and now this will be a very, very interesting thing to watch, to trying to get these sides to come together and meet some common ground. And he even mentioned that the other night in his press conference. He's reinstated stem cell research. Science over ideology, imagine that. That would be nice if the Texas School Board would do that, wouldn't it? He banned torture. He's closing Guantanamo Bay. Restored habeas corpus and the Geneva Convention. Got an economic stimulus package passed that helps more than just the wealthiest of the wealthy. And in his attempt to forge a bipartisan support for the stimulus package, and I'm pretty sure there weren't anybody from the other party who voted for this, he said, you can't just listen to Rush Limbaugh and get things done. And then when he was pressed, he said, I won the election. I will trump you. And he repeated that the other night in his press conference, but in a little milder fashion. He said of bipartisanship, I cannot simply go along with ideas rejected by the American people in a historic election. Gandhi taught, we are all tarred with the same brush, and are children of the one and same Creator. Fearlessness is the first requisite of spirituality. Cowards can never be moral. The acid test of nonviolence, Gandhi said, is that in the end, the enemies are converted into friends. Obama appears thus far to speak and act on the courage of his convictions and to relate to the common humanity and goodness in his adversaries. I find that Unitarian Universalists and activists are very good at the first one, of speaking and acting on the courage of our convictions. I find that, including myself, we are gravely challenged to honor the common humanity of our adversaries. So flashback now to the plane ride to D.C. As we were landing at Reagan Field, I turned to the young woman who had now put up her Ann Coulter book, and I said to her, what is it you're studying in college? She said, I'm a nutritionist. I'm studying nutrition. And I said to her, I said, you have one of the most important jobs of the coming age. You probably know the obesity rate of Americans and the obesity rate of young kids growing up. The job that you are going to undertake is going to be one of the most important jobs in America. Instead of doing what I had wanted to do, to engage in some sort of debate with the woman about the book she was reading, I was thinking about, literally, what would Obama do? And I was able to take a different tack with the woman. When President Bush, former President Bush, landed in Midland, Texas, where I used to live out in Fort Stockton, he gave a speech to a cheering partisan crowd. And think about the words of Gandhi about how those who are adversaries can become our friends. President Bush, former President Bush said, "Today was a great day for America. A good man took the oath of office. And we all offer our prayers for his success." Amen.